you want them to be? Asked Parker. Africa? Antarctica? Somewhere else beginning with A? Like Alpha Centauri? Parker did his best to look hurt on the Fulci's behalf. You know, too much of that kind of talk and they'll get to thinking you don't like them. That would be bad. How much worse could it be? Said Dave. They already drink here. You still have a roof and walls. Just about. Over by the men's room, a fist-shaped hole marked the spot where Paulie Fulci had chosen to express his unhappiness at the result of a recent hockey game. Parker hadn't been present on the night in question, but according to regulars, the whole bar shook. Dave mulled on the Fulcis for a while. His face brightened. If they open their own place, he said, maybe they'll drink there instead. Parker decided to cut that one off at the pass. You're clutching at straws. The bear is like a second home to them. And you never drink in your own establishment. Look on the bright side. You haven't had any trouble since they started coming here. But we didn't have any trouble before they started coming here either. I think they interfere with my blood pressure. They arrive and I feel the urge to lie down. You could always just retire and sell them the bear. It would be like handing my child over to pirates. Go on, admit it. You kind of enjoy them. I really don't. You'd miss them if they were gone. I'd welcome the opportunity to find out. Parker called for another drink and took in the bar, the other customers, and the two men in a booth by the wall. He had caught both of them glancing at him moments earlier, in a manner that was something more than casual, or so it seemed to Parker, and he had learned long ago not to ignore his instincts on such matters. The man in velvet was older and unknown to him, but the smaller one made his skin crawl, and his face was familiar. The guy's in the next-to-last booth by the wall, he said to Dave. One dresses off a frequent buyer card at Goodwill, the other like he got lost on the way to a seance. Know them? Dave didn't even need to look in their direction. This was why Dave was good at what he did, and the bear ran so smoothly. Velvet Gold Mine, no, but the smaller one, he's been here in the past. Not often, but enough for me to learn not to like him. Any particular reason? His attitude, mostly. Other than that, pure prejudice. He's usually alone, but always on the periphery of someone else's business. He's the kind of guy who likes watching kids search for lost pets, because he's the one who makes sure the pets were lost to begin with. Why? I got the feeling they're paying me more than passing attention. Well, you're a handsome man. I won't argue with you on your birthday. The little one, I don't think it's the first time he's given me the bad luck squint in this place. That may be why he's ringing my bells. I get the feeling you're about to make a more formal introduction. Parker patted Dave on the shoulder. Well, this is a friendly place. Quail was listening intently to the little man, who had finally admitted to a name, Ivan Giller. Quail didn't particularly care to find out anything more about him. All he wanted from Giller was what he knew, or could find out, about Karis Lamb and her child. And now, also the private investigator named Parker.
He was on TV. Visiting the burial site, said Giller. The reporter made a fuss about it. Slow news day, I guess.
And you've come across him before?
Not one-on-one, but our mutual acquaintances pay me to keep an eye on him, and I pass on anything worth knowing. Not that I have to most of the time. They learn about the big stuff without my help. If there's trouble, he'll find it. If there isn't trouble, he'll make some. Just for a way to pass a few hours.
Has he made any of this trouble for these mutual acquaintances?
It's an ongoing project for him, which is why I'm still here.
The more pertinent question is, why is he still here?
You mean, why isn't he dead? People have tried.
Clearly not hard enough.
You'd be surprised. You...
A shadow fell across the table, and both men looked up at the face of Charlie Parker. Chapter 52. Quayle and Giller were not alone that evening in considering the possible implications of Parker's involvement in their affairs. Holly Weaver was sitting at her kitchen table, drinking a glass of Maker's Mark, light on the ice and heavy on the bourbon. The Maker's was a Christmas gift from her father. Holly rarely drank hard liquor, but once or twice a month she liked to treat herself to a small one, usually over a book or while watching an old movie on TCM. So each Christmas, Owen Weaver presented his daughter with a bottle, and this was usually enough to take her through to the next Christmas. Not this time, though, Owen thought. This one wouldn't even carry her to Easter, not unless she started watering it.
I saw him,
said Holly.
On the TV, the private detective, the one who hunted down all those bad people.
Owen wanted to ask Holly when last she'd eaten, and if she was managing to sleep at all, because his daughter had begun visibly to waste away since the discovery of the body, and her eyes stared out from reddish-blue hollows. Instead, he said, "We're not bad people."
It won't make any difference to him.
He can't know any more than the police do.
Maybe not yet, but he's not like the police. He's different. Jesus, the stuff on the Internet. If even half of what they say about him is true.
Owen was of the opinion that virtually nothing on the Internet was true, and most of what was true wasn't worth reading. But he also acknowledged that he might just be part of a dying generation, and eventually he and those like him would cede their places to men and women who thrived on conspiracy theories, the echo of their own voices, and the opinions of dogmatists and fools. Owen had Holly's laptop open on the table before him. He was clicking through the searches in her history, taking in a headline here, a report there. He knew Parker's name, and something of Parker's reputation from his own research, but Holly had discovered much more. Even allowing for falsehoods and exaggeration, this was a man to be reckoned with.
"But who could have hired him?" said Owen. "If he's a private investigator, someone must have paid him to sniff around."
Holly looked at him. She was still frightened, but the tincture of her fear altered.
"What if it's the people Karis was running from?"
"No, it's not."
"How can you be sure?"
"Because I've been reading the same material as you," said Owen, "and I don't think Parker would accept their money. All those cases? Murderers brought to justice, missing women found, children saved from Christ knows what kind of end. They share some sense of morality, of right and wrong."
"They say he's killed people."
"They do," Owen admitted. "But if anyone believes the world is poorer for their absence, they're keeping quiet about it."
Holly knocked back a mouthful of bourbon large enough to empty her glass. Owen hoped that at least it might help her sleep. It wouldn't be good sleep, but in her current state, any rest at all would be a bonus.
"He'll come here," said Holly. "He'll find his way to my door."
"You can't know that."
She was no longer looking at him. She was staring over his shoulder at the window, her gaze penetrating the glass and taking her into the darkness beyond, moving through forest and glade until it alighted at last on a man approaching from the south, his advance inexorable, his intent to deprive her of Daniel.
"You're wrong," she said.
Owen closed the laptop. He'd seen all he needed to see.
"Then we have a choice," he said.
"Tell me."
"We wait for Parker to arrive, and the police with him."
"Or?"
"Some of these stories mention two lawyers here in Maine. One in Portland and the other in Falmouth. Parker's done work for both of them. The woman in Falmouth, I don't know, and it doesn't look like she's engaged with Parker lately. But I've heard of the second, Caston. I can talk to him. Just over the phone. No names. I'll be careful."
Holly put the glass down. She started to cry.
"No,"
she said.
"It's all the law."
"We need help. We have to tell someone what happened. We should have done it as soon as they found the body."
"They won't believe us."
"We'll make them believe us. It's the truth."
I can't lose him, Daddy. I can't. I'll die.
Owen reached across the table to clasp her hands. He closed his eyes. He could feel again the spade in his hands and the ache in his arms and back as he dug the hole. The form of the woman in her makeshift shroud and the weight of her in his arms as he laid her in the ground. They had made her a promise, he and Holly, but it was one they should never have kept. Owen saw another path appear, one in which the police were called in the aftermath of the birth, and the child was temporarily taken from them while a process was initiated that ended with Daniel as his daughter's boy, but without the secrets and without the fear. A fairy tale. Because there was another possibility. The woman identified, Daniel in care, and finally, the appearance of the father, come to claim his son at last.
Don't let them have my baby.
A dying woman's words, her hand in Owen's, still slick with her blood. Holly beside them, holding the child, this wailing boy. And something in the way Karis Lamb says those words makes Owen want to tell his daughter to smother the newborn's cries, to silence him with whispers and caresses, with the warmth of her flesh and the scent of her skin, lest the hunters might hear. Because unspoken yet still unacknowledged between his daughter and him is the certainty that Parker and the police are not the only ones to be feared.
Don't let them have my baby.
Them. He knew it would be only a matter of time before Karis Lamb was identified. And then they would descend. Chapter 53. Despite Giller's efforts to bring Quayle up to speed on Parker, the lawyer was still surprised by his own response to the detective's arrival at their table. From across the bar, Parker had resembled just another customer. Average height, hair graying, his body perhaps refusing as yet to acquiesce entirely to the softness of middle age, or not without a fight. But Parker was different when viewed up close. It wasn't as though any single facet of his character appeared more remarkable in proximity, although Quayle was prepared to make an exception for the eyes, which suggested a degree of insight both unusual and hard-earned. Looking into them was like staring at the play of light on the surface of the sea, the greenish-blue of them communicating compassion, sadness, and a potential for violence that once unleashed would not easily be subdued. But Quayle thought also that there was about Parker a certain otherworldliness, a sense of one with an acute awareness of the ineffable. Quayle had encountered other such individuals in the past, but they were often ascetics, occasionally fanatics. Parker, from what Quayle knew, was neither. He was simply very, very dangerous. "Gentlemen," said Parker, "I hope you're enjoying yourselves tonight." Quayle noticed that he kept his body slightly angled, so he could monitor both them and the crowd at the bar, in particular, Moore's. Somehow, he had picked up on her presence, even as she kept herself at one remove.
"Very much," said Quayle, "although it's a little noisy for my liking."
"Not from around here, are you?"
"Just visiting."
"English?"
"Yes."
"Business?"
"Mostly."
"And what kind of business would that be?"
"Are you the welcoming committee?"
"The regular guy is off, and I'm still working on my people skills." Parker waited for Quayle to answer his earlier question. The three men understood what was unfolding. Neither Quayle nor Giller made any effort to protest at Parker's intrusion on their conversation, or to pretend that this was anything other than what it was— an adversarial confrontation brought down upon them by some moment of carelessness on their part, or the detective's responsiveness to threaten predation.
"I'm involved with the legal profession," said Quayle at last.
"A lawyer?"
"Yes."
"You could have just said that."
I don't practice very much anymore.
Yet here you are, on business.
Indeed. Here I am.
The printed sheet lay by Quayle's right hand, the cryptic crossword puzzle from that day's edition of the Times of London. Completing it was one of Quayle's pleasures, and he had been forced to subscribe temporarily to the newspaper using a proxy account in order to enjoy it while away from home. Quayle's fountain pen lay alongside it, and the index finger of his right hand bore a telltale smudge of ink.
"Puzzle fan?" said Parker.
"Only of this particular crossword."
"Looks like you finished it."
"I always complete it, although some days it takes longer than others."
"I'm sure there's a metaphor in there somewhere, or a lesson for life."
"If I discover it, I'll be sure to pass it on."
"That would be just fine. Do you have a name?"
"Yes."
"Care to share it?"
"No."
Parker nodded once, as though Quayle had just confirmed everything he needed to know about him, before turning his attention to Giller.
"You, I think I've seen before."
"I couldn't say."
"I have a good memory for faces."
"How's your memory for faces?"
Giller shrugged, but didn't answer.
"I ask because it seemed that you were paying some attention to my face this evening. I'm just wondering if on those other occasions when I've seen you here, you might have been doing the same thing."
"I think you're mistaken."
Parker considered this. "You could be right," he said, "but I doubt it. And I bet you're not the sharing kind either when it comes to names."
"Smith," said Giller. "My friend across the table is also Smith."
"Well, Smith and Smith," said Parker. "Or Smith 1 and Smith 2, as I'll think of you from now on. I'm glad we got the formalities out of the way. Broke the ice. Next time we'll all be more comfortable with one another. I'll keep my eyes open, because I wouldn't want to miss you. Until then, you enjoy the rest of your evening."
He backed away from them, pausing only to tap the bar just to the right of where Paletta Moore's was sitting.
"You too, miss."
Quayle watched him rejoin the group, but Parker only stayed a few moments longer before leaving through the front door.
"Will he wait?"
asked Quayle.
"Possibly,"
said Giller.
"But he can't follow both of us at once, and if we leave now, he won't have time to call for assistance."
"So which one of us will he go after?"
"We'll just have to see."
"And the matter of the child?"
"I'm already working on it. I'll be in touch."
"Sooner would be preferable."
"I'll bear that in mind."
They made their way from the bar, Moore's behind them. The owner, the birthday boy himself, gave no sign of noticing their departure, nor did anyone else. Once they were outside, Giller turned left without another word, then left again, and was quickly gone from sight. Quayle and Moore's headed right, in the direction of their rental car. But as they approached it, Moore's took Quayle's arm.
"Let's walk a while."
"What about the car?"
"We'll come back for it later."
"Why?"
"Because he's watching, and the car can be traced. He's sharp."
"Sharp enough to have spotted you." Moore's bristled.
"Yes."
Moore's checked behind her, but saw no sign of the detective. She looked puzzled, even disappointed.
"Why doesn't he come?"
she said.
"Because he knows we're here, and what we look like," said Quayle. "Perhaps he'll use other channels to find out why."
Eventually, they neared the ramp for 295, where Moore's hailed a passing cab. As they climbed in, neither of them paid any attention to the figure limping along the other side of the street, his progress assisted by a bright red rollator. Only when the cab had slipped onto the highway did he reach into his pocket and carefully text the company name and license number of the cab to the number he had been given by the man outside the Great Lost Bear. It was the easiest $20 he'd ever made.
Chapter 54.
Bobby Ocean was also in a bar that night, In his case, the Gull's Nest over in South Portland's West End. Bobby had recently used one of his subsidiary corporations to take ownership of the Gull, as it was universally known. Over the preceding 18 months, related companies had also acquired rental properties in the Brick Hill and Red Bank neighborhoods and along Western Avenue. The city council was planning to revitalize the area by improving roads and building sidewalks, as well as authorizing zoning changes and implementing a public-private proposal for affordable housing. The West End was on its way up, and Bobby Ocean would be in an ideal position to exploit this ascent. The only blot on the horizon was Bobby's son, who was currently holding court in a corner of the Gull and had already begun shooting his mouth off about the new proprietors. Billy had petitioned his father to be permitted to manage the Gull, and his mother had added her voice to her son's. How could Billy be expected to become more responsible, she argued, if his father wouldn't trust him with leadership? This seemed to Bobby to be putting the cart before the horse. But his protest fell on deaf ears, just as his wife preferred to ignore all the times Billy had failed to step up in the past. Those jobs, she claimed, just weren't right for their son. They were too restrictive. He was a sociable boy, she said. People liked him. Maybe she really believed this, but Bobby thought she spoke more in hope than anything else. Their son was not sociable, just easily led. Folks didn't like him. They liked his money, which Billy threw around freely enough to buy himself a circle of regular acquaintances. Some were plain old bottom feeders, but others were of a more dangerous stripe. Bobby wasn't planning on dying anytime soon, but he still worried about the future of the businesses he had so painstakingly built up over the years. Billy was his only child, and the only one Bobby Ocean was ever likely to have. He was also, unfortunately, an asshole. That fucking truck. If only Billy hadn't bedecked it with Confederate banners. But there was no talking to him. True, he might have inherited his fundamentalist views on race, not to mention women, homosexuals, and the poor from his old man, but that didn't mean he had to go around advertising them. The truck flags were just part of it. Billy had also involved himself with that Klan nonsense up in Augusta, which was arrant stupidity. Billy had been smiling when he told his father about it, as though expecting to be praised for what he'd done. But Bobby Ocean was a respectable figure in the state, and ensured his support for far-right causes was discreet and largely anonymous. What effect did his son think it would have on the family name if he were questioned for disseminating hate literature? What the fuck was he thinking? But Bobby Ocean shouldn't have struck him for it. That was a mistake. The open-handed blow had landed on the side of Billy's head almost before his father realized he had thrown it. And then, God damn it all, the boy had started weeping. Jesus Lord. So maybe he'd have to throw the Gull to Billy. It was a shithole anyway, and eventually Bobby would have to close it for refurbishment, maybe put in a pizza oven once the hipsters began gathering. Billy could do what he wanted with it for a year or two, so long as he didn't run the place into the ground. And if Bobby gave him the Gull, Billy might stop brooding on his truck, and that would be a good thing. There was no proof that Parker and his Negro had been responsible for what occurred, even if Bobby knew they were involved. Knew it in his heart. He'd find a way to punish them for what they'd done given time, but he didn't want his son going up against a man like Parker. From the heart of a group of laughing men and women, all morons and blowhards, his son raised a glass to his father, and Bobby returned the gesture. After all, he loved his son, and perhaps it was partly his fault that Billy had turned out this way. Still, he couldn't help but feel that some better version of the boy had dripped from his mother's vagina before it could reach the egg. Chapter 55. The text came as Parker shadowed the man he was now thinking of as Smith One. Parker knew the type. A crony, a consort, a willing servant to the demands of others, regardless of their moral complexion, just as long as they paid promptly. Although the Smith Ones of this world preferred that the morality of their employers assume tones of gray fading to black. Which wasn't to suggest Smith One lacked intelligence. He was keeping his head down as he headed along Ashmont, maintaining a steady pace and not looking back, but Parker was sure he was primed for the possibility of pursuit, if not already actively aware of his pursuer. Not that Parker cared. He didn't intend to follow Smith One for very long. What Parker did intend was to grab Smith One at the first opportunity before encouraging him to share any and all information he might possess about his drinking companion, along with details of anyone else that might have paid him to monitor Parker's movements. Parker closed the gap as Smith One passed Cottage Street. Deering Avenue was the next big intersection, and Parker didn't make Smith One for a Portland local, which meant he was unlikely to have walked to the Bear. Either he was catching a bus on Deering, or he was parked somewhere nearby. Smith One crossed Cottage before stopping as something to his left caught his attention. He turned slowly, his eyes drawn by a presence as yet concealed from Parker's gaze. For a moment, the texture of the night appeared to thicken, the shadows deepen. Parker tasted metal on the air, like the coming of an electrical storm. He could hear cars passing in the distance, but their sound was muffled, and the surrounding houses began to lose their definition. He had the sudden uncomfortable sensation of being immersed in water or lost in a rapidly descending fog, without either medium being made manifest. Only Smith One remained fixed and unchanged, so that the two men found themselves trapped in a space warping into immateriality. A naked child crouched in the center of the street, pale and malformed, naked and sexless, its leg and elbow joints bent at unnatural angles, its right arm shielding its eyes as though from a light visible only to itself. It extended its left hand toward Parker, and despite the distance between them, he thought he felt its touch on his skin, the nails on its fingers sharp and cold as needles. Smith One started to run, but Parker could not tear himself from the child. It possessed a kind of reality, being both present yet insubstantial. It looked as though it might be possible to pass straight through it, but one would deeply regret the experience, like breaching a cloud of chlorine gas. Slowly, the child began to glow. Parker glimpsed the network of veins and arteries running beneath its skin, and what might have been internal organs, lungs, kidneys, a heart, albeit atrophied and seemingly without function, for the lungs did not swell or contract, and the heart did not beat. The light grew stronger, splitting apart, and Parker heard the roar of an engine and the clamor of a horn, and he just had time to press himself against the side of a car as a van ripped through the child, its body vanishing at the moment of impact, and passed Parker with barely inches to spare, the driver mouthing obscenities at him as he went. The child was gone. In its place was a great chunk of dirty ice, possibly displaced from a building or truck by the thaw, and tire-marked by the passage of the van. If it had ever resembled a child, it no longer did so. Smith One was also gone. Parker waited for his hearing and vision to return to their normal states, but they did not. He was nauseous, and it was all he could do to return to his own car, where he remained seated behind the wheel until some semblance of order was restored to his senses. When he was sufficiently recovered, he called the cab company that had picked up Smith Two and his partner. He told the dispatcher he believed he might have left an item in one of its taxis, and was given a cell phone number for the driver. Parker contacted him, but was too tired to make up any more stories. He identified himself as a private investigator and promised a 50, if the driver told Parker the drop-off point for the fare he'd picked up on Forest Avenue about half an hour earlier.
"For $50, said the driver, "I'd tell you who killed Kennedy."
Parker settled for the location, a single-story strip motel out on Route 1, although he did ask the driver if he'd happened to overhear any conversation in which his customers might have engaged.
"They didn't talk at all," the driver said. "I didn't take them for friendly types, not even toward each other."
"Why do you say that?"
"They were linking arms when they hailed me, but as soon as they got in the cab, they moved to opposite doors."
Parker thanked him and told him he'd put the cash in an envelope and drop it off at the cab office in the morning. He then drove out to the motel, showed his ID and a 20, and informed the old guy behind the desk that he was interested in two guests, a man and a woman. Parker described them in as much detail as he could, as well as giving an estimate of the time they had probably returned to their rooms that night. The old guy examined Parker's ID before handing it back, minus the 20.
"Nope," he said.
He was wearing a T-shirt that read, "Bowlers do it with two balls," which Parker decided was barely a single entendre.
"Nope what?"
"Nope, we don't have anyone of that description staying here tonight."
"You sure?"
"Four rooms taken, two by young couples, two by old couples, and by old I mean old. I'm old, but they're real old. They're so old they might be dead by now."
"You could have told me all that before you took the 20.
"You should have held on to the 20 until you got an answer. You been at this PI business for long, son?"
"I'm considering retiring."
"Yeah?"
"Yeah, I might cash out and use the money to buy a can of gas to burn down this motel."
"I don't care. It isn't my motel. And the way you throw money around, you won't have enough left to pay for matches, never mind gas."
"I don't suppose you saw a cab pick up a couple outside a while back."
"Saw a cab, but didn't see who got in or out. None of my business."
Parker decided that the night wasn't about to get any better. Not at this late stage. Sometimes a man had to learn when to take a write-off. "You'll understand if I don't thank you for your time. I figure I've paid you enough to skate over the niceties."
"That you have. But if you ever need a place to stay, I'll get you a good deal."
"Someplace else, I hope," said Parker, and left. Parker's head was still swimming as he neared the turn into his driveway. He used his phone to check the status of the security system. It was second nature to him since the attack that had almost taken his life, but it still irritated him, reminding him of his own vulnerability. The system was green. No one had entered the property since his departure earlier in the evening. Had anyone done so, the phone would have beeped an alarm, and the nearest camera would have sent him a picture of the intruder. He parked, went inside, and searched the medicine cabinet until he found some pills that claimed to tackle both headaches and nausea, prescription medication left over from the aftermath of the shooting. He wasn't even sure they were still in date, but he swallowed two of them dry before heading to his office and sitting by the window, staring out at the moon on the marshes, the saltwater tributaries trickling like molten silver to the sea. He thought of Smith 1 and Smith 2, and the woman with them. Smith 1 he might be able to trace. Someone had to know of him and where to find him. But the other two, they were interesting. Maybe he should have stayed with them and left Smith 1 for another occasion. But all this was just a temporary distraction, a means of avoiding the contemplation of what he had witnessed on Cottage. A child. Or just a patch of ice in the shape of one, distorted by Parker's tiredness and the tones of the night. But Smith 1 had seen it, too. What's more, it had scared him. Whomever or whatever Smith 1 was involved with, he'd neglected to examine the small print on the contract. Parker felt a drowsiness begin to descend. He knew he should go to bed, but he didn't want to leave his chair, didn't want to look away from the marshes. He understood why. He was hoping to catch a glimpse of Jennifer, the gossamer reassurance of her presence. This was her time. Night, with her father caught between wakefulness and unconsciousness. But Jennifer did not appear, and soon Parker slept. Chapter 56. Quail walked alone by the shore of the Piscataquis River, the lights of the inn now distant. Moores was asleep in her own bed, in her own room. If he wanted to be with her later, he would summon her. The drive back to Dover Foxcroft had not been a pleasant one. Meeting Giller in Portland was a mistake, because it had exposed them to Parker's regard. Quail could understand why Giller considered it important for them to know about the private detective. Could even at a stretch accept that Parker had to be encountered in person to understand his strangeness, and therefore the potential threat he posed. But Giller should have found another way. Quail was smoking, a vice he deeply enjoyed, but one that was growing harder to indulge in these intolerant times. He smoked only Chancellor Treasurer cigarettes, silver-tipped, and housed in a gunmetal case. They were expensive, but money was not an issue for Quail. He had more of it than a man could spend in 10 lifetimes. And Quail would know. He cared little about this world, beyond the square mile or so of London that he thought of as his own. Cared little, in truth, for the world beyond his own rooms, for they contained infinities within themselves. He maintained only sporadic contact with those whose concerns impacted his own. Quail's obsession was the Atlas, and the Atlas alone. Therefore, the fact of Charlie Parker's existence had passed Quail by until now. But everything he had learned from Giller, confirmed by his own brief encounter with the detective, provoked in him an unease of such intensity as to be almost refreshing. In a life so long lived, even fear was a welcome distraction from the mundane. What troubled Quail most was the inability of anyone, but particularly the backers, to deal conclusively with Parker. According to Giller, any number of individuals had tried and failed. With a cadre of concerned citizens in a small Maine town named Prosperous coming closer than most to neutralizing the detective. Yet the backers possessed pressing reasons to kill Parker, and the resources to accomplish it. Why, then, had they not yet done so? What was lacking? A possible answer came to Quail as his cigarette burned down to the butt. He flicked it into the dark, the hiss of its destruction lost in the river's tumult, and turned back toward the inn. A conversation was required. The principal backer would be called upon to justify himself. Reasons. Yes, these the backers had. Resources. Yes. But the will. That remained to be seen. Chapter 57. Parker drove up to Bangor shortly before noon the following day. The air was bright and clear, and when he stopped for coffee along the way, the conversations of those at the diner counter appeared infused with the kind of hope that he always regarded as unique to northern states. It came with spring, surged with summer, and was entirely spent by the coming of winter. Because of Dave Evans's birthday celebration, and the less welcome events that followed, Parker had missed most of the coverage of the most recent press conferences held by the state police. The conference had been postponed from earlier in the day due to what turned out to be a false sighting of Heb Caldicott up by Crowsville close to the Canadian border, which meant the news teams had struggled to put together packages in time for their evening broadcasts. As a result, Parker was forced to flip between his phone and the Portland Press Herald as he played catch-up. It was clear that the hunt for Caldicott and his associates had dominated proceedings, with only a few minutes at the end given over to the ongoing mystery of the woman in the woods. A state police lieutenant named Solange Caraveau was now the lead investigator on the case, following a reorganization of MSP resources following Allen's murder. Parker didn't know Caraveau, so she was either new to the force or recently promoted. It stood to reason. The main focus was on the hunt for Allen's killers, so the less pressing investigation was always destined to be handed off to whomever could be spared. On the other hand, the condition in which Jane Doe's body was discovered, buried after recently giving birth, the remains of the placenta interred with her, meant that, by police reasoning, a female officer would present a more appropriate public face. And in this case, police reasoning might have been correct. Parker went to the Channel 6 website and pulled up the video of the conference, making sure to use earphones to listen in order to avoid bothering the other diners. Corriveau was in her early 30s and spoke slowly and clearly. She shared with the press almost every detail already known to Parker and emphasized that law enforcement had a number of aims in the investigation: to identify the woman, to establish the circumstances of her death, and to confirm the whereabouts of her child, because the search of the area around the grave had revealed no trace of the infant.
"Is this a homicide investigation?"
asked an unidentified male reporter.
"We have no evidence to suggest it was a homicide,"
Corriveau replied.
"It appears most likely that the woman died as a result of complications in childbirth, but we'd very much like to find out how she ended up in that situation."
She then changed her tone, making it softer, less formal.
"It may be that someone out there believed he or she was doing good by giving this woman a burial and taking care of her child. Sometimes people do the wrong things for the right reasons, and we understand that. But there may be a mother, a husband, or a partner who cared about this woman, and they have a right to know what happened to her and her child. So if you have information that might help us in this, anything at all, we're asking you to come forward so that we can start setting some minds at rest. We're not looking to put anyone behind bars, and we'll be as sympathetic as we can. But the longer this goes on, the harder it will become for us to reach a resolution that's best for everyone involved."
With that, the clip ended. Parker was impressed. Corriveau had done well. No threats, but just enough steel at the conclusion. He put his phone and newspaper away, folded his reading glasses, and ordered a second cup of coffee and a to-go cup. Once outside, he made a call to Gordon Walsh.
"I watched the press conference," he said. "Where'd you find Corriveau?" "Presque Isle PD." "She's good. Tell that to the bonehead screeching about affirmative action. We'd still have hired her if she was a Martian. Like you say, she's good. Did you call just to compliment us on our progressive hiring policies?"
"I felt like passing the time of day. What you doing?"
"Seriously.
I crossed paths with a guy at the Bear last night. Small, 5'2", 5'3", looks like a rat that's figured out the basics of tailoring. Not local to Portland, but my guess is he's a Mainer, although you couldn't tell from the accent. I think the term is studiedly neutral. He was accompanied by an Englishman claiming to be a lawyer and a woman who hasn't seen sunlight since Reagan died."
"Any name?"
"He said it was Smith, but I'm not inclined to believe him."
"I'm shocked, but I don't doubt your instinct for dissimulation. Why the interest?"
"I think he may have been keeping tabs on me. Not regularly, just occasionally."
"It's not much to go on."
"I'll talk to Dave Evans. We might get something from the cameras in the bar."
"If you do, send me the images and I'll ask around, but I can't promise anything. You still snooping for Moxie on the woman in the woods?"
"I am. In fact, I'm on my way to do some snooping right now."
"If you find out anything, share it with Corriveau."
"Done. You have a number for her?"
Walsh gave him Corriveau's direct line and her cell phone.
"How's Angel doing?"
"Improving."
"That's good to hear. And the other one?"
"Still no change in his condition."
"That's less good to hear."
"But not unexpected."
"No. And remember, Corriveau."
"Understood. And thanks."
"Doesn't mean we're dating again," said Walsh, and hung up.
The exterior of the tender house had not changed a great deal since Parker's last visit. Its status as a refuge for frightened and abused women was still unadvertised, and only the electronically operated steel gate and the fact that its high white picket fence was made of metal instead of wood suggested the two adjoining clapboard buildings might house anything other than another pleasant condo development. Parker left his car at the curb and rang the bell on the gatepost. He kept his head up so the cameras over the main door and on a nearby tree could see his face clearly. His arrival was anticipated, but it was still a good 30 seconds before he was admitted. He knew the reason for the delay. While two cameras were watching him, other eyes were monitoring the street for any signs of suspicious activity, just in case a husband or boyfriend with a grudge decided to seize the opportunity offered by an open gate to enter the property and reclaim his chattel. Cars were parked on the street, but all were empty, and any pedestrians were both distant and seemingly occupied with their own concerns. But Parker was careful to walk quickly into the driveway once the gate opened, and he didn't turn his back on it until the barrier closed safely behind him. Candy stood waiting for him at the main door. She was wearing her beloved pink bunny slippers. Her hair remained slightly unkempt, and her smile had not altered one iota. It signaled unconditional pleasure at Parker's presence. Candy had Down syndrome, and was the daughter of the original founders of the Tender House, both of whom were now deceased. She continued to live and work on the property, and much of its identity was tied up with her. She was a link to its past, but also a symbol of everything it stood for. Candy, in essence, was tenderness.
"Charlie Parker," she said, "what are you doing here, my darling?"
And she gathered him to her in an enormous hug, and he held her in turn, closing his eyes briefly against the world.
"Are you better now?"
she asked. "Better for seeing you."
"But you got shot."
"Yes."
"You mustn't get shot."
"That's good advice. I'll bear it in mind for the future." A woman emerged from the depths of the house. She was big and busty, with a manner that projected both strength and compassion. Her hair was grayer than before, and Parker thought she moved with a certain caution, even weariness, that was new to her. This was Molly Bowe. If Candy was the heart of the Tender House, then Molly was its brain, its muscle, its sinew.
"I wasn't flirting,"
said Candy, as soon as she became aware of Molly's presence.
"Are you sure?"
said Molly.
"Give me a break," said Candy. "Charlie Parker's my friend."
She turned to Parker for confirmation of this.
"Right?"
"Right, and I brought you a gift."
"A gift? For me?"
Parker handed over a bag from Treehouse Toys, containing a design-your-own stationery set, including stickers, stars, and glitter. Candy liked making cards for the women and children in the Tender House. She left them on pillows and slipped them under doors. Her face lit up when she peered into the bag.
"Thank you,"
said Candy, and hugged Parker again.
"I must go and make you a card to take home."
"I'd like that a lot."
"A birthday card."
"But it's not my birthday."
"It doesn't matter."
And Parker decided that perhaps it didn't. You accepted birthday cards when and where you could. A birthday card it is, then. Candy headed into the house. Parker walked up to Bo and embraced her, although he noticed that she kept him at one remove. "How are you, Molly?"
"I'm okay," she replied.
"Just okay?"
"I got beaten up."
"When?"
"About a month ago."
"I didn't know."
"We kept it quiet. The police were informed, but we didn't want to alarm any of the women. How can we expect to make them feel safe if we can't even look after ourselves?"
"Who did it?"
"No idea. He wore a ski mask. So I figure it was some prick whose wife or girlfriend might have passed our way. He caught me as I was coming out of a movie. I should have parked closer to the light. He tried to drag me into the bushes. I think he had a mind to rape me, but he settled for kicking the shit out of me instead."
"How bad?"
"A couple of busted ribs and a lot of bruises. I managed not to get my nose broken, which is something. I always liked my nose."
"That wasn't what I meant."
"I know. Physically, I'm on the mend. Psychologically, that's another matter. I guess we have that much in common, right? But come on inside. I'll make you a cup of coffee, and you can tell me what brings you to our door."
If the facade of the tender house was unchanged, its interior had undergone considerable renovation. An extension to the back of the main building now offered two rooms that could be used for meetings or therapy sessions, along with a small medical clinic and a new kitchen.
"We received a bequest," Beau explained, "enough to put together all this. We also have a nurse who comes in 3 times a week and a therapist for 2 afternoons.
She made coffee for both of them and left Candy behind the main desk working on Parker's card with instructions to shout if she needed help. Beau and Parker went into the smaller of the new rooms, leaving the door slightly ajar. They sat opposite each other, a box of tissues on the table between them.
"So, why are you here?"
Beau asked. "The woman's body found up in Piscataquis."
"I don't know much beyond what I've seen on television and read in the newspapers. They're saying it wasn't a homicide and she died of complications from childbirth."
"Probably postnatal hemorrhaging due to placental abruption, or that's what's coming from the ME. No sign of any other injuries."
"And you're investigating this?"
"In a way."
"On whose behalf?"
"Moxie Caston's."
"Moxie Caston is a lawyer. So he's employing you on behalf of a client?"
"No, it's all Moxie."
"Why?"
"A Star of David that was carved into a tree by the grave. Moxie's Jewish. Trying to trace Jane Doe's child is his service for the dead."
"Which means you're his service for the dead?"
"Yes."
"You seem to spend a lot of time serving the dead."
"I serve the living, too."
"Not so much."
Parker conceded the point. "Could she have been someone with whom you were in contact?" he asked.
"I don't think so. I went back through our records following the police appeals. We had a couple of pregnant women pass through here during that time, but the ages don't match. Do the police think there's any chance she might be local?"
"It's unlikely. She'd be on file, or someone would have come forward by now. You know how this state is. It's 35,000 square miles of small town."
"You could have told me all this in a phone call and spared yourself a trip. Why'd you need to look in my eyes?"
From outside came the sound of Candy humming as she worked. "Jane Doe was pregnant," said Parker, "and from outside the state. The fact that she ended up buried in the woods means she was probably in trouble from the start. So what drew her to Maine?"
"Family? A friend?"
"Then why hasn't anyone claimed her?"
"Maybe the father of the child was a Mainer, or living here from away."
"Again, the same question," said Parker. "Why not come forward?"
"Because he killed her."
"Nobody killed her. She died."
"She was left to bleed out. There are all kinds of ways to kill a woman. Some don't even involve laying a hand on her."
"Okay, let's say I accept that. Why let her die and then keep the child? Look at it objectively. What's the point in concealing a postnatal death and burying the body on woodland, which is risky, all to hide a baby?"
"I can come up with reasons," said Beau. "None of them suggestive of a positive outcome for the child's well-being."
"Once more, all that may be true. But you're starting at the end and working back. I'm still a whole set of steps behind you."
"Where exactly?"
"At the point where she gets here and looks for help."
"Assuming she did."
"Molly?"
"Fine. Fine. So, she seeks help. But she didn't come to us."
"And if she'd approached any of the other services or refuges in the state, there'd be a record of it. Someone would remember."
"Right."
"Then who do you turn to if you're really frightened and really, really at risk and you don't want to be remembered?" Molly stared at Parker, but said nothing. "The tender house is discreet," Parker persisted. "But the fact that you could be dragged into bushes and beaten, in all likelihood because of your work here, confirms a certain awareness of your presence. Sometimes discreet isn't enough."
"You're fishing."
"You know me better than that."
"What are you suggesting?"
Parker had been asking around. He'd even spoken to Rachel, his ex. Rachel was a psychologist and had worked with victims of domestic violence. She'd made some calls on his behalf and come back with a piece of information she'd been unable to substantiate, but that was, in her view, more than hearsay. I've heard rumors.
About?
Safe houses. Women and children in trouble, being passed from place to place, all under the radar, and only the most desperate of cases, the ones barely a step ahead of a violent death. No police involvement, no state or local services. They go in one end of the tunnel and come out the other far away.
Fairy tales.
I don't believe that's the case. Molly sat back in her chair and folded her arms. Her demeanor didn't augur well.
And if all that were true, don't you think these individuals might also want to help solve the mystery of this woman's identity?
Not if it meant explaining how they knew.
You're asking me to betray confidences.
Molly, there's something very wrong here. I'll do all I can to protect sources and not endanger anything you or others may have worked hard to establish, but I need to make my way back along the chain. This woman deserves better than an anonymous burial in a pauper's grave, and out there is someone who knows where her child is. Slowly, Beau unfolded her arms, and Parker thought again about how tired she appeared. It wasn't just the recent assault. Perhaps there was only so long a person could bear witness to the damage men were prepared to inflict on women without falling victim, even temporarily, to despair.
"I'm not supposed to know," she said. "And you make it sound like some kind of formal structure or secret organization. But it's not like that. There's no one network, no hierarchy. There are only people who want to help, who remain in loose contact with one another, and understand the value of staying low."
"I won't share this with anyone else, not even Moxie."
"Jesus."
She breathed deeply.
"I'll give you a name, but..."
Parker waited.
"You'll have to tell her I sent you,"
said Beau.
"And then she'll never trust me again. None of them will."
"I'm sorry."
"No, you're not. I like you, I really do. But in so many ways, you're just another man. You're convinced of the rightness of your own cause. You know best, and you'll threaten and wheedle and cajole until you get what you want. When you're done, you'll look back at the havoc you've created, and all you'll be able to do is shrug and make your apologies."
Parker didn't reply. He knew some of this was true, and the part that wasn't didn't matter.
"You need to talk to Mela Lombardi," said Beau. "She lives not far from you, over in Cape Elizabeth."
Parker recognized the name. She was a schoolteacher.
"Yes."
He tried to picture Lombardi. He thought he might have seen her once at a community gathering. He asked Beau for contact details and was given two numbers, home and cell phone, along with an address. "Are there others like Lombardi in Maine?" he asked.
"Not that I know of."
"And you'd know?"
"I would."
"And in the rest of New England?"
"I don't have that information."
"You certain?"
"Don't push me, Parker."
"And when Molly Beau told you not to push, you were advised to stop pushing." "Thank you," said Parker.
"Don't thank me either. Your gratitude won't make me feel any better."
She stood. Their meeting was over. Parker felt a kind of sadness. He understood that their relationship had shifted irrevocably, and not for the better. She walked him to the door, where Candy was waiting with a birthday card. He accepted it and received another hug for good measure before Candy went to her room to take a nap, leaving Parker alone with Beau. Her arms were folded again. It looked like Candy's would be the last hug he received at the tender house. "I know," he said to her, as he stood on the step, the street beyond still empty.
"You know what?"
"That you lied to me earlier." She stared hard at him and waited for him to continue.
You can identify who assaulted you, if you're not certain you're as good as. She stayed silent for so long that Parker became convinced she was going to let him walk away without any reply at all.
I have no proof, she said at last.
He'll do it again, if not to you, then to some other woman.